Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is preparing for attacks outside of Gaza.
But we are also preparing for scenarios of challenges in other arenas. And we established a simple principle. Whoever hurts us, we hurt him.
Plus, heavy shelling on civilian infrastructure in Kyiv.
Ukrainian national power company Ukrenergo reported that as a result of the attack, their power substations and generation facilities were damaged in the Odessa, Zaporizhia, Lviv, Kharkiv, and Kyiv regions.
And later, migration in Europe. And the UN says we've got to act fast to save the world. Today is Thursday, April 11th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel is continuing its war in Gaza, but is also preparing for scenarios in other areas. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Thursday, amid concern that Iran is preparing to strike Israel in response for the killing of a senior Iranian commander.
We are in the midst of a war in Gaza, which continues in full force. At the same time, we continue our unceasing efforts to return our hostages. But we are also preparing for scenarios of challenges in other arenas, and we established a simple principle. Whoever hurts us, we hurt him. We are preparing to meet the security needs of the State of Israel, both in defense and in attack. I and the people of Israel trust you, and may we all have great success.
Netanyahu was addressing staff at an Air Force base in southern Israel. Iran has vowed revenge for the April 1st airstrike on its embassy compound in Damascus. It killed a top general and six other military officers, further escalating tensions in a region already convulsed by the Gaza war. Meanwhile, updating a story that broke yesterday, an Israeli missile strike in Gaza has killed three sons and several grandchildren of Hamas's political leader, Ismail Haniyeh. Linda Gradstein has the latest from Jerusalem.
Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh said Wednesday that an Israeli airstrike killed three of his sons and at least two of his grandchildren. The Israeli army confirmed that it was responsible for the attack, saying all three were active in Hamas. The army did not say where the strike took place, but Haniyeh said it was in the Shati refugee camp where they lived. In an audio interview with the Al Jazeera news channel, Haniyeh, who is based in Qatar, said the killing of his sons would not affect Hamas's positions on a deal for a ceasefire in exchange for hostages. He said that Hamas's demands are clear and specific, and that Hamas will not make concessions on them. He said the blood of his sons is not dearer than the blood of the Palestinian people. Al Jazeera reported that the drone strike came as they were traveling in a car to visit relatives in Gaza on the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, which began Tuesday night. While Haniyeh was based in Qatar, his 13 children lived in the Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza. Unlike many other Palestinians in Gaza, they did not leave the north for the southern Gaza city of Rafah. It was not clear how the Israeli airstrike would affect the ongoing negotiations that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt are holding to try to reach a ceasefire deal in exchange for the freedom of at least 40 Israeli hostages. Israeli analyst Donna Weiss says the negotiations have proceeded slowly. She says Hamas has been delaying its response to a U.S. proposal for a deal, saying it cannot find 40 hostages that fit the category of humanitarian cases. There are 133 Israelis still being held in captivity, although Israel says at least 35 of them are dead. The patience of the families of the hostages has been running out, as they fear that time is running out to get their loved ones home alive. Meanwhile, Israel has pulled the majority of its soldiers from Gaza, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to insist that Israel will enter the southern Gaza city of Rafah to attack the remaining four Hamas battalions. U.S. President Joe Biden has grown increasingly critical of Netanyahu's handling of the war, which has killed more than 33,000 Palestinians, both gunmen and civilians, and sparked a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Meanwhile, a new poll in Israel finds that almost three-quarters of Israelis think Netanyahu should resign, either immediately or as soon as the war ends. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
In other Israel-Gaza news, Israel is constructing a new land crossing into the Gaza Strip designed mainly to facilitate deliveries of humanitarian aid from overseas or from neighboring Jordan. Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
Well, Hamas continues to hold 133 hostages and use Gazans as human shields. Israel continues to facilitate the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and find new ways to increase this effort. We are constructing the northern crossing, a new land crossing from Israel into northern Gaza, to enable more aid to flow directly to civilians in the areas that have been challenging for the trucks to access. These new measures enable us to bring more aid and trucks destined for Gaza from overseas, including the Via land crossing with Jordan.
A spiraling humanitarian crisis has placed pressure on Israel from its Western and Arab partners to do more to facilitate the entry of aid. Israel has gradually reopened two established cargo crossings and created a new crossing on its border, and last week announced it would admit Gaza-bound aid shipments at the southern port of Ashdod.
We expect 58 trucks a day to pass through. Following the cabinet's decision, we have worked with international partners to bring in more aid from the sea via the port of Ashdod, after which it will be transported down to the crossings into Gaza. The combination of these new measures means that we expect the daily average of trucks of food, water, medicine, and shelter supplies going into Gaza to go up gradually from 350 per day to around 500 per day. All of these efforts are due to close coordination with international partners and aid organizations to maximize our combined humanitarian efforts.
It's hoped that the new crossing point will boost the delivery of aid brought in overland from Jordan. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The Speaker of the House in just a moment, but first, this update from Kyiv. During the latest massive attack, Russian forces destroyed a power plant in the Kyiv region, which was the largest supplier of electricity for three regions. Meanwhile, President Zelensky is in Lithuania to hold defense cooperation meetings. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Before dawn on April 11th, Russian forces launched a massive missile and drone attack targeting Ukrainian energy infrastructure, mainly in the Lviv and Kyiv regions. The city of Kharkiv was under ballistic attack the whole night. Ukrainian national power company Ukrenergo reported that as a result of the attack, their power substations and generation facilities were damaged in the Odessa, Zaporizhia, Lviv, Kharkiv, and Kyiv regions. The company also confirmed that emergency electricity restrictions are in place in the Kharkiv region. The head of the Kharkiv military administration reported at least 10 airstrikes at critical infrastructure facilities in the city of Kharkiv and the region. Local authorities in the Lviv region also confirmed hits at infrastructure facilities, including a gas distribution site and an electricity substation. No casualties were reported. In the Kyiv region, Russian forces destroyed the Tripilya thermal power plant, which was the largest supplier of electricity for the Kyiv, Cherkasy, and Zhytomyr regions. As a result of the strike, the turbine department caught fire. The employees of the plant were not injured. Local residents of Ukrainka near the plant reported a series of explosions around 5 a.m. The attack was conducted with both drones and missiles. Andriy Gota, the head of the supervisory board of Santarenergo, which owns the plant, said that the scale of the destruction is terrible and cannot be measured by money. He called it the biggest challenge in the entire history of the enterprise. Currently, the company has lost 100% of its generation. In March 2024, the Russian forces destroyed the Zmeivska power plant in the Kharkiv region, and in July 2022, the Vuhleyerska power plant in the Donetsk region, which were also owned by the company. Meanwhile, President Zelensky announced a new Ukrainian missile production program to increase Ukrainian military capabilities and improve the situation on the battlefield. Zelensky said,
I held a meeting regarding our missile program with the Commander-in-Chief, Minister of Defense, Minister of Strategic Industries, and heads of relevant enterprises. Serial production and new samples of missiles. The details aren't public, but our defense industry has the necessary results. And the main thing is for the Army to implement these results now.
This announcement was followed by the Ukrainian parliament voting on a new mobilization bill aiming to increase the defense capabilities of the country. The new norms will come into force after the bill is signed by President Zelensky. More details will follow. On April 11th, President Zelensky was also visiting Lithuania, where he held meetings and negotiations with the leaders of Lithuania, Latvia, Czech Republic, and Romania. The main topic of the discussions was the defense cooperation. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
We've reported on this show before about the stalled efforts in the U.S. House of Representatives to pass a funding bill that would help Ukraine. VOA's Katerina Lisanova caught up with Speaker of the House Mike Johnson on Wednesday, and while his answer to her question was succinct, it does provide an encouraging update.
2 weeks ago, you said that Congress will work on aid to Ukraine without hesitation, quote, one comeback after recess. What is the plan right now, and what are the possible terms for aid to Ukraine?
We're still working on that, as I said in there. That's going on as we speak.
The situation in Ukraine is dire, and congressional funding for Ukrainian aid has the U.S. military concerned as well. On Wednesday, General Christopher Cavoli, the head of the U.S. European Command, told Congress that for every shot the Ukrainians take, the Russians take five. For more, VOA's Alexis Strope spoke with our national security correspondent, Jeff Selden.
So where is Ukraine right now in terms of its access to weapons? Are they running out of time? Are they running out of weapons? Where are they right now?
Well, for weeks, U.S. officials, military officials, defense officials, intelligence officials have warned repeatedly that Ukraine has been forced to ration its weapons, ration its munitions, use less than it otherwise would, because it is waiting until the U.S. and lawmakers in the U.S. approve a $60 billion security assistance package. And on Wednesday, the commander of U.S. European Command, who oversees U.S. forces in Europe and is responsible with looking at the security situation in Europe for the U.S., gave lawmakers on the House Armed Services Committee a very stark, a very blunt assessment of where things are. And he said that not only does Russia create a chronic threat, but that Ukraine essentially is on the brink. He said that while he can't predict the future, he said, quote, I can do simple math. And he said that if the U.S. does not continue to support Ukraine, Ukraine will run out of artillery and shells and out of air defense interceptors, the munitions they need to repel Russian attacks in the air. He said, quote, in fairly short order. And he said in his experience, if one side can shoot and the other side can't shoot back, he said, quote, the side that can't shoot back loses. And he said that that is accelerating rapidly right now for Ukraine. Right now they're being outshot by the Russians 5-1, he said, in a matter of weeks. And he said, this isn't a hypothetical, Russia will be able to outshoot Ukraine 10-1.
It seems like at the top, U.S. President Joe Biden, Senator Chuck Schumer, Speaker Mike Johnson, they all seem to see the necessity and the urgency behind this. But what is the delay in actually getting the funding done? What is with the slowdown here?
Well, it really comes down to what the Speaker of the House, Republican Mike Johnson, is willing or is not willing to do. And thus far, he's been unwilling to bring this security assistance package, which was passed by lawmakers in the U.S. Senate back in February. He's refused to bring it to the floor to a vote. Now, in the House Armed Services Committee, the chairman of the committee, the vice chairman, Republicans and Democrats, there's a good deal of bipartisan support for approving that legislation, approving the package so that the president can sign it and the aid can go to Ukraine. But there are a small number of Republicans who are very much against this package. They have a variety of concerns, a variety of complaints. One of the lawmakers during the hearing was arguing that, you know, it seems that unfair that the U.S. is so concerned about you securing Ukraine's borders when it is not doing, in his opinion, nearly enough to secure its own borders. But the message from General Cavoli, General Christopher Cavoli, the commander of U.S. European Command, from other defense officials, is that time is running out. And there is no one else that can provide Ukraine with the assistance that it needs. That while European allies, European partners have done quite a bit to provide Ukraine with tanks, munitions, and other weapons, when it comes to the type of artillery that Ukraine desperately needs, and when it comes to resupplying the air defense systems, the only country in the world that can provide that right now is the U.S. And so that if the U.S. doesn't provide it, eventually the clock will run out and Ukraine's ability to resist Russia will evaporate.
VOA's Alexis Strope. She was speaking with national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Elsewhere in Russia, having nothing to do with the war in Ukraine, areas near the border with Kazakhstan are experiencing historic flooding. In the city of Orenburg, the Ural River has risen 10.6 meters. Reuters' Leila Shahroshahi has the story.
Floods engulfed cities across Russia and Kazakhstan on Wednesday after Europe's third longest river burst its banks, swamping parts of the Russian city of Orenburg and forcing over 100,000 people to evacuate. That included Valentin and Evgenia Perednia, forced to steer a motorboat through the streets. They sent their children to a parent's house out of town, but stayed behind to protect their home from looters.
We have no police, no security guards, no one here. We're guarding our homes and neighboring plots by our own efforts. Where can you go? Nowhere.
Rapidly melting snow has swelled major rivers, including the Ural, which runs through Orenburg towards the Caspian Sea. Climate science professor at Reading University, Maria Shargendanova, said the unusual floods may be explained not only by heavy snow this last winter, but also the speed of the melt, possibly due to climate change.
Snow started melting very rapidly because temperatures were rising very rapidly. And within basically days, temperatures went from zero and to 17, 18 or even 20 degrees. And that's what caused a very, very rapid snow melt.
Russian officials said it is the worst flooding in Orenburg since records began. Russian news agencies quoted the emergencies ministry as saying 38 tons of aid, food, drugs and other necessities had been flown into the region. Kazakhstan has said nearly 100,000 people had been evacuated from flooding within its borders. Russia said over 10,000 houses were flooded across 37 regions, most in the Orenburg Oblast. Upstream on the Ural, which flows into Kazakhstan, floodwaters burst an embankment dam in the city of Orsk last Friday.
That's Leila Shahroshahi of Reuters reporting for us today. Elsewhere in Europe, on Thursday, European Council President Charles Michel welcomed the EU vote on a revamped migration system.
You know that the European Parliament voted a few hours ago the migration pact, a good thing, because this is an improvement of the tools we have in our hands to be in control, point one. And you know that together with Italy, with Professor Meloni, we are working very hard to engage with third countries outside of the EU, origin countries, transit countries, so that we have a broad cooperation with those countries, including in the field of migration.
European lawmakers on Wednesday approved the revamped migration system that the pro-EU political center promises would reduce irregular arrivals. This as it seeks to stem gains by the far right ahead of the bloc's parliamentary election in June. The plan aims to cut the times for security and asylum procedures at external EU borders, and it increases returns to reduce unwanted migration from the Middle East and Africa. In climate news, a dramatic statement by the head of the United Nations Climate Agency on Wednesday warned that humanity only has 2 years left to save the world. VOA's Laurie London has that story.
With governments around the world facing a 2025 deadline for new and stronger plans to curb carbon pollution and crucial global finance meetings later this month in Washington, UN Executive Climate Secretary Simon Steele, in a speech Wednesday at the Chatham House think tank in London, said, while his warning may sound melodramatic, wealthier nations need to step up.
We still have a chance to make greenhouse gas emissions tumble with a new generation of national climate plans, but we need these stronger plans now. And while every country must submit a new plan, the reality is G20 emissions are around 80% of global emissions.
He said if emissions of carbon dioxide and methane from burning of coal, oil, and natural gas continue to rise, it will deepen the inequalities between richer and poorer nations, where communities contributing the least to the problem are the most impacted by climate change.
So when I say we have 2 years to save the world, it begs the question, who exactly has 2 years to save the world? The answer is every person on this planet.
And in a bumper year for elections around the world, with voters going to the polls from India to South Africa and the United States,
a recent survey by Gallup of 130,000 people in 125 countries found that 89% want stronger climate action by their governments. Yet too often, we're seeing signs of climate action slipping down cabinet agendas.
Scientists say climate-damaging greenhouse gas emissions need to be cut in half by 2030 if we are to stop a rise in temperatures of more than 1.5 Celsius that will unleash more extreme weather and heat. Yet last year, the world's energy-related CO2 emissions increased to a record high. Current commitments to fight climate change would barely cut global emissions at all by 2030. Lori London, VOA News.
Here in Washington, the United States and Japan celebrated their decades-long alliance on Wednesday night as President Joe Biden hosted Prime Minister Fumio Kishida at the White House for a state dinner. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
The leaders unveiled new initiatives, including a joint lunar mission, investment in semiconductors and clean energy, and research on quantum computing and artificial intelligence. But the strongest focus is on military deterrence, enhancing cooperation not only in the South China Sea, but also in the air.
For the first time, Japan and the United States and Australia will create a network system of air, missile, and defense architecture.
There will be an upgrade of command and control of American and Japanese soldiers, increasing force interoperability. With ramped-up defense spending and high-tech capacity, Tokyo is a key player in Biden's regional strategic architecture to deter China. Japan is set to begin supporting the AUKUS partnership between the U.S., Australia, and the United Kingdom, said Kishida. He said nothing has been decided on Japan having a direct cooperation with AUKUS. Going forward, with U.S., U.K., or with Australia, in a bilateral or multilateral framework, Japan will continue cooperation. Biden and Kishida will expand their meeting into a trilateral summit Thursday, adding Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., another U.S. ally. That meeting will focus on freedom of navigation as tensions in the South China Sea ramp up between Beijing and Manila. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.